Welcome to another edition of Lex Talk History, a podcast produced in collaboration with WUKY and the Lexington History Museum. Now, here's your hosts, Lexington History Museum Executive Director Mandy Higgins and WUKY's own Alan Lytle.
Hello again, Mandy.
Hi, Alan.
Boy, what a weekend we have just been through with the Lafayette commemoration. 200 years from this weekend, as a matter of fact, this past weekend, that he visited Lexington.
Yeah, you know, I've been getting a lot of inquiries about Lafayette over the last week or so. And at first, we had all the joy of Bill Swinford telling us about Lafayette's visit. But I was a little like, okay, guys. Cool. This guy came and he hung out. That's what we do in Lexington. We super love to fete and do these things. But it was an incredible few days of celebrating 200 years of Lafayette and of his impact in Fayette County. And, you know, it really can't be overstated that we have Lafayette High School. We have Fayette County. All of those things matter to who we are today. So it was really fun.
Yeah, you talk about a legacy, and it also happens to be Lexington's 250th anniversary.
Right. Yeah, I think a lot about this, especially as we're coming up on some of the biggest moments of the 250 celebration. Lafayette was here at the 50th, and what does, like, that is sort of glossed over in the Lafayette lore of the visit, that this was also it was a Lexington moment, and I'm really curious, like, I don't ever want to time travel. I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast, but I don't.
No better time than now to talk about it, I'd say. Let me get on the analyst's couch here and say, why would you not want to travel in time?
Because by and large, there is no better time to have been a woman in America than the 21st century. So why would I, like, I only want to time travel if I can also shapeshift and be, you know, like, a wealthy man or something. So I don't want to time travel. But I would be very curious if we could find, like, a 1825 day in the life journal of someone who actually acknowledged that it was the 50th anniversary of Lexington. Or maybe they didn't because it didn't matter then, right? Maybe 50 years wasn't enough to really feel like a thing. The city didn't have a mayor yet. It was still being sort of directed by trustees, and, you know, a lot of things were very different. So I've been thinking a lot about, like, was it acknowledged? Did this actually happen? Or did we just, like, wake up in 1875 and decide, like, yes, now it's time, we can celebrate?
Well, we are certainly making up for lost time, yes, then in that vein, because we are going through 250 years, and it's like a year-long celebration thanks to 250 Lex.
Yeah, it is. And, it, you know, we're right in the middle of it. We've made it to May. And this month is, I think, really, given sort of where we are in our celebration and where we are in the state of the world, it's really an exciting month for Lexington to acknowledge how many different people make up this city and have made up the city from the very beginning. May's theme is Diversity Month, and we're getting at that in lots of really exciting ways. At the museum, we have a temporary pop-up exhibit that was guest curated by Preeti Gupta, who is on the 250 Lex Commission and is a realtor and here in town and does a lot of other things. She's really incredible. But it features items from seven family groups from nations all around the world who've settled here in Lexington and made their lives here in Lexington. A Kenyan immigrant who's only been here for like 2 years, all the way through to a woman from China who came in 1974 and hasn't left. Like, Lexington is her home, right? It is all of their homes, but it's this really incredible piece, and it's fun, and it's fashion, and it's those sorts of things. And then there are lots of things happening outside of the museum, including Diversity Fest on May 24th downtown. That's going to showcase like 30 performances of various folks I know my daughter's ballet studio is doing a piece from their Dia de los Muertos dance. Shout out to Bluegrass Youth Ballet, who are incredible.
Well, how about we just go right into Let's Get Into It then?
Well, and part of why we chose and have Gwen Thompson from the Mary Todd Lincoln House here with us today for Let's Get Into It is because we have a story of diversity and difference and ways of thinking about Lexington that aren't often associated with Mary Todd Lincoln. So, Gwen, can you tell us first a little bit about you and about the Mary Todd Lincoln House?
Well, my name is Gwen Thompson. I'm the director at the Mary Todd Lincoln House. We're located right in downtown Lexington, Kentucky, in the heart of the city. And we have always been in the heart of the city. This building has been there for over 200 years. We are the childhood home of Mary Todd Lincoln. She was not born there. Her birthplace was demolished a long time ago. So this is the house that she essentially lived in as a teenager and young woman. And her family continued to live there after she was well into adulthood. And she did bring Abraham Lincoln to Mary Todd Lincoln House to visit her family after they were married. So he's been there as well. Our interpretive focus is really the entire biography of Mary and a lot of a variety of people who were in her orbit. Specifically, our mission is to cultivate public interest in the multi-layered past through the story of Mary Todd Lincoln. And her story resonates in lots of ways today. So I think today we're going to talk a little bit about some of the people who were enslaved by the Todd family and who labored at and lived at the present-day Mary Todd Lincoln House. We might end up focusing specifically on a woman named Chaney Dickerson. Her story is pretty interesting. But I'm also happy to branch out into some of the other individuals who we know some things about. Yeah, so we can get into the overlooked aspects of the history at the Mary Todd Lincoln House, or not overlooked by us, but just ones that maybe information that's not as known, particularly for, you know, if people read Mary biographies, some of the details that we have aren't just not in those biographies because the research just wasn't available to researchers. It kind of takes a lot of digging. And so, yeah, let's get into it.
Yeah. Real quick, before we talk about Chaney Dickerson and some of these other folks, it is Diversity Month. And for the museum, we're thinking internationally, by and large. So I've been sort of deep diving into Guiron, confectioner. Can you, and this is a setup for Chaney, too, just to bring our listeners along. Tell me a little bit about Mary and her sweet tooth.
Well, so there are family stories about Mary Todd Lincoln that have been passed down, and there is or a couple of them associated with I'm going to butcher his name, Maturin Jerome. I can't say the first name, but you know, he was a confectioner. He had a operation in downtown Lexington. Part of that structure still stands today, and he at one point the bottom level of the building was the bakery. The upstairs had a dance hall, if you will. And he was a pretty famed locally confectioner. And the stories, as it relates to Mary and the present day lore, is that he created a very elaborate cake in honor of General Lafayette visiting Lexington. And the story is that that recipe was passed on to the Todd family, and that Mary Todd Lincoln brought it with her into adulthood and baked it, and it was Abraham Lincoln's favorite cake. So there's a lot of Lincoln lore around what's often called Mary Todd Lincoln's white cake recipe now. Google it. You'll find lots of recipes. There's YouTube videos of people making it. People are very into sort of the food lore as it relates to Mary and to Jerome.
Yeah. And that that confectionery was on Mill Street, which is only, you know, a hop, skip, and a jump from the home that she spent that would have coincided with when the confectionery was there, so the Mary Todd Lincoln House. And I read, and maybe this is also lore, because, you know, the thing about the Lincolns, there's so much lore.
Yeah.
Some of it's very hard to pin down. But I read that not only was she obsessed with this white cake and it became sort of hers, but that she also would stop in on days when she was maybe not enjoying Mentels or not enjoying her stepmother and get her afternoon pick-me-up.
So, to my knowledge, there's no primary source evidence, what I would consider primary source evidence of her having, you know, done that. But there certainly are stories about it. Some of our family stories are, you know, they're being written in much, much later, such as a 1928 biography of her. Right. You know, that's 110 years after Mary was born. But definitely her, Mary as a young woman or teen child visiting Girons is a part of the family story and lore, which is interesting because, you know, they have a lot to choose from to be put into this bio of Mary. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that Girons was a significant enough figure that he made it into the story.
Yeah, those are, I think that's so fascinating. And, you know, we probably should make clear that, like, a confectionery is not like you're going into Martine's today, right? Like, there would have been a case, there would have been things like that, but it was not nearly as a ubiquitous sweet shop as you would think of today. So this was still something that's very extra. Like, it's a, you would have to work for it.
Oh yeah, special occasion.
Yes.
Because households all over the city were cooking and baking for daily use.
Right.
So a Girons confectionery was a special occasion, or that's my impression of it. I do not claim to be an expert on Girons by any means, but that is my impression.
Same.
You know, not to make a comparison that's not perfect, but I'll make it anyway. You know, like getting a wedding cake.
Right.
You don't just go in every day and look at the wedding cakes. You know, it's a special thing.
That's why it stuck out to me that this, like, story was, oh, she just popped in and got herself a pedophore. Like, we don't do it. We do that today because life is hard. Life was hard in the 19th century, too. But, like, we all need our afternoon pick-me-ups. I get it. The idea of a 1825, I've just had a really rough Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go get a pedophore.
Mm-hmm.
Feel better about it.
Yeah. And the connection also might in part be born, or the story of Mary did learn French as a child or young woman while she was studying at Charlotte Mantel's academy. Charlotte Mantel was a French immigrant. She spoke French, and Mary learned to speak French there. And Girons also spoke French, although you look into Girons, it gets confusing. There are times where there's one record that says he was Swiss, but, you know, he's established as being French. But in Switzerland, people in Switzerland who speak French is their primary language. So definitely he spoke French. And so the story is that she liked to go kind of talk to him in French and stuff too. Yeah.
But to bring it back to why we're actually here, part of that cake lore is that she cooked it or she baked it. And we know in the 19th century that Mary Todd Lincoln was likely not baking.
As a child and in her young youth, Mary would probably not have been getting her hands, dirty in the kitchen, because, of course, the Todd family had enslaved women who performed a lot of those tasks and labor in the Todd household. Later on in adulthood, Mary did cook because she was a middle-class housewife. She had help in Illinois, domestic servants who assisted her, but Mary did actually cook then. But in her childhood, no, probably not. At the Mary Todd Lincoln House, on average, there were 5 men and women enslaved there. The number of people enslaved there fluctuated over the years. According to family stories, one of those people was a woman named Cheney. And in their stories, she is remembered as the cook, and she is remembered as a very good baker. And we know that based off of a couple of stories of theirs, including one in which Mary is at Mantel's, and they're having some kind of event. And Cheney is bringing a special cake to Mantel's Academy in celebration of that. And the family's together, and they're teasing Cheney that this cake is so fabulous, they're going to tell Mary that it was made by Girons rather than Cheney. So that's a testament to, you know, Cheney's skill that she baked a cake that would be comparable to what you'd expect to get from Girons. Mm-hmm. And then there is one other family story about Cheney and baking, and that is in later years, later being Mary's adulthood, Mary visited the family in adulthood a couple of times, and there's a story that she wanted to learn how to make beaten biscuits because her domestic servants and cooks in Illinois didn't know how to make this classic Kentucky dish, beaten biscuits. And so she asked Chaney to teach her how to make it. And Chaney was, you know, rattling off ingredients and how to do things just from memory. And Mary was struggling to try to keep up and write it all down. So that's an interesting story, too, because Mary's trying to learn how to do this, and she's trying to take notes to keep track of it. But Chaney, of course, she did not know how to read and write. She learned the art and skill of cooking from other enslaved women, and she just had to keep it all in her head.
How do you know these things? How have you been able to get this into the Mary Todd Lincoln House, to have these sorts of stories as part of what you're able to interpret?
Well, those two stories about Chaney are family stories, and they are pretty readily available in that early 1928 biography by her Mary's niece, Catherine Helm. But they are very surfacey, if you will. They don't really tell us a lot about Chaney beyond that at one point a woman named Chaney labored in the Todd household, was enslaved there, and performed this specific type of domestic labor. So learning more about her specifically has definitely been a challenge, but there's still a lot we don't know, but we have been able to learn some more things about her. In her case, some of the leads, or many of the leads, come from legal records. So in this era, we have tax records, we have census records. These are all very impersonal. But after Mary Todd Lincoln's father, Robert, died in 1849, the Todd family ended up having a lot of litigation and internal squabbles over how to settle his estate. And the individuals that he owned were legally a part of his estate. So their names appear in the records over a period of about 3 years of Todd infighting, and that provided leads to be able to learn more.
Yeah, so what did you tell me? Tell me a little bit about what you learned.
Yeah. So Chaney was legally owned by Mary's father, Robert S. Todd. He names her in his deathbed will, and he names her two children and a couple of individuals. So her children that he names are Pendleton, or Penn, and her daughter Mary Ann. And those children are roughly about 7 and 3. So he names them in his will. So we know their names. In the family stories, Chaney's kids do not appear. There is no Pendleton in the family story. There is no Mary Ann in the family stories. She had children. And the family, Todd family stories, do not ever mention that she had children. So those are important leads. And the records also tell us the tumultuous events of those periods for Chaney, her children, and for the other people who were enslaved by the Todd family. And technically some people were owned by extended family members, and what happened to them in those periods. So initially, when Robert Todd dies and his estate is going to go through a long period of being battled over, the Todd family removed to a farm in neighboring Franklin County. It's present-day Woodford County. And it's believed that Chaney and her kids initially went there. But early on, her son Penn, who was about 7 to 9 years old, was actually sent to labor with another Todd family member, one of Mary's brothers, Levi. So he is just a 7 to 9 year old child. He's very, to the present day, I think very young. But he is separated from Chaney and sent to essentially begin laboring for this other family member. Chaney and her young child, it's believed, were probably initially at the farm with the Todds. She was legally the property of the estate. And so part of one of the decisions that was made was to hire her out. Hiring practices were extremely common in this era, particularly in our region. And at one point, Chaney was hired out in Lexington. And we believe that she was hired out to a woman named Miss Susan Cook, who actually had a boarding house in downtown Lexington. So in 1850, the boarding house had 18 people who were boarders there. So it's it kind of is a fit for Susan Cook might have wanted to hire the labor of Cheney to serve as the cook for all of these people she had living in her boarding house.
Do we know where in downtown? Like, would it have been a familiar spot for Cheney to come back to?
It was in downtown Lexington, around, I can definitely get you the details later, but around like the downtown core, like the Phoenix Hotel area. It was significant enough that there are newspaper articles where other businesses are referencing their location as being like in proximity to Miss Cook's boarding house.
So it drives me crazy. As a 21st century researcher, like, give me something, just a road, something, so we can know. But yeah, that in the practice of hiring out, you mentioned the Phoenix. That's such a, the Phoenix was a common place for folks to be hired out to. Lewis Hayden is hired out to the Phoenix at one point before right. he escapes enslavement.
So she's hired out in Lexington. Her son, Penn, has been removed from the family member's house. Where, by the way, in the legal records, they say that he was whipped a good deal. From their perspective, they said that he was basically troublesome. He was a 7 to 9 year old child, separated from his mother. And so he was eventually removed, not necessarily because he was whipped. They just chose to remove him to the farm. And then at one point, bear with me here, the Todds appear to be coming to some kind of an agreement on who in the Todd family will get different enslaved individuals who are owned by Roberts' estate. They would have to purchase the individuals from Roberts' estate, and they seem to be getting close, but then it all really just falls apart and gets really, really bad for Cheney and her family. So at one point, this Todd relative, George, that would be Mary Todd Lincoln's youngest brother, takes Penn and another man named Harvey to where he lives in Harrison County. Cheney and her younger daughter are still technically considered in the possession of Betsy Todd, although Cheney may be being hired out. The courts and the people involved in all of this thought that this was a concurred upon agreement between George and Mary's stepmother, but it was not. And so they're squabbling back and forth. And eventually they just say, the courts do, forget it. If you cannot come to agreement, we'll just put them all up for public auction and let the highest bidder win. And so in November of 1852, Cheney and her children, and by this time she had also had a third child, Lewis. He was only 2 months old, a babe in arms, and her son, Penn, were put up for public auction at the courthouse door in downtown Lexington. We know that her son, Pendleton, was actually valued in advance separately from Cheney and her younger children. And Cheney, according to Todd family stories, was purchased by Mary's stepmother, the widow, at the auction. But we have no further records of what happened to Pendleton or Penn at all. So we don't know if he was purchased by a member of the Todd family, if he was purchased by some other higher bidder, and if that's when the family officially faced permanent separation.
And not to get too legalese about this, but because Robert Todd didn't have an enumerated will of Mary inherits this person and George inherits this person, as was common in the 19th century, this is why it had to go to probate and litigation and those sorts of things.
He wrote a very hurried deathbed will. He got sick very quickly and died very quickly, and he wrote a hurried deathbed will. And it was challenged as not having been properly witnessed, so it was deemed invalid. And that is when, so essentially it's like he died without a will. And so they need to divide his assets among his heirs, and his heirs include his widow and his 14 children that lived to adulthood. So in many, they essentially needed to liquidate his estate to be able to divide the proceeds among his heirs, or his heirs could buy part of the thing, items from his estate, and take that as a part of their compensation for the estate.
So Cheney remains in the possession of the Todd family.
Correct.
Through the Civil War.
Correct. So she was, and definitely she and her youngest son, who was the babe in arms, definitely were purchased together. We do not know for sure whether her daughter Mary Ann was purchased with her or not. Her daughter was about 6 years old. My gut is that she was, and that they were separated from each other by later events. So 8 years after the auction, Mary and at least two of her younger children were sent to Western Kentucky to be in service and servitude to a family member, Alec Todd. And in those intervening years, those 8 years since the auction, Cheney had had four more children. Her husband was likely a man named Lewis Dickerson. Lewis is listed on the death certificates for three of her younger children as their father. So the children born over an eight-year period, they all have the same father. So he is her husband. So in 1860, Cheney is sent to Western Kentucky, specifically to an area in Muhlenberg County, to labor on family land as this young Todd brother is establishing a farm in Muhlenberg County. So at that point, it is almost certain that either, well, almost certain, she's been separated from her husband. She had just had her youngest child, and her husband obviously was here in Central Kentucky, probably Lexington. So she is separated from her husband at that time. She is separated from her older children, who we have no records of them ever, the older ones, ever reuniting, being with her in Western Kentucky. And she's sent there shortly after she is forcibly moved to Western Kentucky. The Civil War begins, and Alec Todd joins the Confederate Army. And the Todd family chose to hire her out in Western Kentucky throughout the duration of the war. So she's in Western Kentucky. She has several children who are with her, and they're all being hired out during that period. And by hired out, in case I missed explaining that, that means that she and her children are essentially being rented to other people who are using their labor, but they are paying the Todds for the right to use Cheney's labor. So the Todds are receiving income from her labor. She's being treated as a capital asset, which is extremely common. So she's in Western Kentucky throughout the duration of the war with her kids, and then the war ends. And eventually, slavery is abolished in Kentucky, and Cheney is a free woman. And she has choice for the, she has agency and choice about where she's going to be and what she's going to do. And Todd family's stories, or there's a letter specifically written much later, and it talks about her a little bit. And it says that after the Civil War, the Todds invited her to return to them on a wage basis, but that she declined. And she said she was happy providing child care to a family of motherless white children. And she was in that household for a very, very long time. She's in that household, the guest household, in Rochester, Kentucky in 1870. She's there in 1880. In 1870, her youngest child is only 10 years old, and he's there with her in that household. In 1880, one of her sons, who's in his 20s, has actually moved into that household too. And she also has two daughters who live in that same community, and they continue to live there for generations. And her children really go on to have what I would consider a great deal of success, not even within two generations, one generation. It's in the same generation in which they had been enslaved people. So Cheney was born enslaved, but all of her seven children that we know of were also born into slaves. And we know that two of those children, daughters, Eliza and Flordia, went on to become landowners with their husbands. They owned their own homes and farms, mortgage-free by 1900. This is only 35 years after having been enslaved themselves. Mm-hmm. They might have bought their properties earlier. They had large families. Their older children, almost all of them, learned to read and write. All of their children who were school age were in school. And Flordia herself, and I find it moving, she does not know how to read and write most of her life, including all the way up to 1900. But by 1910, she is enumerated as knowing how to read and write. So she learned how to read and write sometime in her late 40s or early 50s. So it's pretty incredible. It's not even, oh, the next generation after slavery achieved these things. Like, these daughters of Cheney were born enslaved,
right,
and they achieved this. I think it's powerful, and I'm like, go Cheney and family.
Yeah, the piece of agency of choosing not to return to labor for the former enslaver is really a powerful piece, and something different than a lot of the stories we hear. And we know of formerly enslaved individuals remaining on the land or returning to be wage earners within the home or the farm of their enslaver. And so that's it's really different.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that?
Oh, I make a lot of things of that. I mean, the source for that is a family member, a sister of Mary's, writing actually to Mary and Abraham Lincoln's son. Their son, the Lincoln son, received lots of requests for assistance. And at one point apparently he had received a request from Cheney, which I would love to find where that is, a letter written to him for financial support. And there is another of her son, Lewis, writing to him for financial support. That one does exist. And so Emily is explaining to him, like, basically verifying whether this, that person who was requesting is or is not associated with them legitimately. Mm-hmm. And whether or not Robert should, be generous or not. But Emily's perspective is very much what you would expect, because she says, Cheney, we offered for her to come back to us on a wage basis, of course, after what Emily refers to as their awful shakeup. and then she said that, Cheney declined. And then Emily kind of goes on to be a little snarky, like, well, I suppose after that family no longer needed her, they just let her, let her go. And on other times, Emily also refers to Cheney as having been under their protection, which is very much what people who were enslavers used to justify them being enslavers, was that somehow they were protecting and providing for. So, Cheney and her kids did not need the Todds to do well. And I would love to know Cheney's perspective whenever she got that offer and she declined what it was. But another interesting thing, I think, is that Cheney, at the late years of her life, actually was laboring for a family called the Evans family, according to the Evans family stories. We know that she was never owned by the Evans family. She was owned by the Todd family. But the Evans family stories is that she was owned by them. Mm-hmm. So in the Evans family stories, they are remembering an aged woman who had formerly been enslaved, and their story was that she was enslaved by them. So that would reinforce the legends and stories that people who were enslaved wanted to continue on with their enslavers. But so that's... In Evan's case, it's like, no, she was never actually enslaved by you. She was enslaved by other people, and she was with you later as a free woman.
Right.
So, I don't know. It makes me wonder if some of the people who think, oh, yeah, well, this person was a slave and they stayed on with my family, it's like, well, were they necessarily owned by your family at that time, or did that relationship come later? I don't know.
Right.
It's complicated.
Very. Well, I think you mentioned that it's Emily Todd Helm who's writing to Robert Todd Lincoln and relaying the story about Cheney. And it's also Catherine Helm, who writes that 1928 biography that gives us the stories of Mary and Cheney that are in them, right? So Cheney is almost a caricature for the Helms in their telling, and kind of in their telling of belittling Mary, right? Like if they're going to, if Cheney is bringing a cake that they're going to say is a Giron cake, and if Cheney is...
Oh, no, no. They're not teasing Mary. They're teasing Cheney. They're... So the source of that is that they're going to tell Cheney that no one believes she baked it.
Okay, I missed that piece.
I don't think I explained that well enough. It was good enough to look like a Giron cake. I was interpreting it from the standpoint of the thing I'm going to kind of gather from this story is she was good enough that they could make a joke that no one would believe she made it and that it had to be baked by Giron. But the root of the story is actually basically about them teasing Cheney. There are a lot of that in their stories involving enslaved people. There's not a lot. There's not that many stories, unfortunately. But it's a theme within the stories of enslaved people, or the some of the women, that there are stories of them essentially being teased or things being done to them that, from power dynamics between child and adult, are questionable, such as a young Mary replacing the sugar for salt for a enslaved woman named Sally. And like, it is told as like, oh, this, you know, this young Mary, she was just such a prankster, but, or hiding Sally's slippers from her. They're definitely, it reflects some interesting power dynamics that even though, you know, Mary was a child, she is, you know, performing tricks and things that might be deemed disrespectful if it was being done to her mother or her father.
Well, and could potentially put these enslaved individuals in extended danger, right? Like if we're replacing sugar and salt and something is cooked poorly and someone has a bad day, that is going to depending on the enslaver, endanger the enslaved person even more than their bondage.
In this particular, I think, instance, I get what you're saying, and you'd be absolutely right. In this story, I think it was about specifically Sally's coffee. So I think it was Sally-specific, you know, trickstering, if you will.
But
I've lost
is,
my train of thought. I'll just admit it.
I mean, I think that to the larger point of how we know these things and that it's deemed acceptable to sort of pass along these stories of, look at how we played with our property, right? Look at how this, look at the relationship between the enslaved and the enslaver as playful and joyful and not what it, right, as you're getting at that power dynamic. And that by and large, until we have an easier time of accessing records like the census and the slave schedules and those sorts of things, all we had were these stories that are a generation or two past who they're telling the story about, and they're told through a very specific lens of the family who enslaved, not the enslaved family.
Right. And, you know, some of the Todd family stories are problematic. You know, they're being written in an era where kind of would expect that in present day we might consider some of them a little problematic. But I am so grateful that they exist because they're elites. And if they didn't, we probably would have an even harder time finding any information about Cheney or they are the reason we know that Cheney was a cook and a baker. And in the 1870 census, she is enumerated as a cook. You know, in their stories, she has no last name. And in the record, in legal records, she has no last name. But knowing that she's a cook helps us confirm in the 1870 census that we probably have the right Cheney. She's age appropriate. She's also a cook. You know, so it provides useful information. But if it's just a sort of like fun, quirky story, and then it gets repeated over and over again when putting together Mary's bio, because there's just not access to other information, so they just repeat it, then it turns, unfortunately, the people who were enslaved and had real experiences into sort of just tropes, you know, for a narrative, to help build out a narrative, instead of really seriously, you know, incorporating their lived experience into the biography of Mary or whatever, you know, part of her story we're telling.
Yeah, I think that is the key to all, right? Like the mission of the Mary Todd Lincoln House is to build the world of Mary Todd Lincoln and the people that she interacted with within that home, right? Mm-hmm. And because you've been able to do this research, you can bring in a more realistic idea of who was in that home and doing that work than if we were building that story only on published material from the 1920s. And that explains why today we're getting deeper stories in history that aren't new necessarily. They're just being told in a fuller way because we have better access to resources and research and primary pieces that were very difficult to get even 20 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, I will absolutely endorse that the modern access, the internet, is a fabulous, fabulous resource. 25 years ago, so much material was, if it existed, it's in an archive, it's over here, it's over there. And I'm sorry, I work at the Little Mary Todd Lincoln House. We're just trying to do our best to get by day to day, you know, get all the stuff done. I'm not getting to go on a trip to Chicago or to Illinois, but a lot of that material is coming online now and is more and more available.
Even something as simple as the census.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, as much as we can sort of, you know, I'll put on my academic hat and be a little flippant about ancestry, the things we can know, because ancestry makes all of those records available and searchable, if you know what to do, so say, know that it's Chaney Dickerson, and so you can follow that name and match up the right age and match up this and match up that, all of a sudden a whole world opens that we couldn't have done in even 1995, because you would have had to pull each individual reel of microfilm for every census from 1870 to whenever your presumption that she died was. And you're not going to get that link of a death record and, oh, here's a birth record. And, hey, look, they moved. And, hey, maybe somebody signed up for World War I or the Spanish-American War or whatever. And it links it together. Now, it's not perfect.
Well, and to build off what you're saying, like the internet, there are two very, very old history books that were really important into establishing the Chaney Dickerson as being our Chaney. And one of them was written in 1885, but it's available online now. I am not looking through 1885 histories just randomly, like read every word to see if the word Chaney or something that looks like it or the word Todd appears, but they're available online and you can search them and see if you get any hits, and you can find that information so much more easily. Yeah. And it's interesting it's inspiring and hopeful to think how much more will be available in 20 years from now, how much more will we be able to discover, which is fabulous. And you mentioned, you know, our work at the Mary Todd Lincoln House, and whenever it comes to interpretation and like slavery, you know, this research is a priority for us. Unfortunately, we're now hitting a lot of dead ends. Please put more stuff online. Help us out. Like when I started there, I mean, talking about slavery and the people enslaved there, to our credit, has always been acknowledged at the Mary Todd Lincoln House. But it was very vague. It was a couple of names, like these are the names from the family stories. It was just very, and then you have to talk vaguely, just kind of generally, of what slavery was like generally. Like, it's true generally, and it's probably true specifically at the Mary Todd House, but we don't know. And there was just this tension between the degree of specificity that we can talk about Mary Todd Lincoln or Mary Todd Lincoln's dad. And then we, on tour, have to talk very generally about these other folks. By the way, I would like to acknowledge that another person who we have to talk very generally about is Mary's own mother, Mary's stepmother. It is, we just don't know a lot about them. So to be able to try to dig, and when we talk about an individual, to be able to talk with specificity that is equivalent to, you know, the specificity that we can talk about Mary's dad, mm-hmm. I think is really important. Because even if you're trying, if you don't have the specificity, it's an imbalance, and it just doesn't work great.
Yeah, I think that's an important caveat to all of this, right? It is incredible what you've been able to find for Chaney and her family. But by and large, all of us are only going to be, like, the lives we're going to be able to recreate about us in 100 years, if someone cares to try and, like, figure out who Mandy Higgins was, is likely going to be at the level of Chaney, not at the level of Mary Todd. And that's because most of us are just living our lives. And so when we can get one of these people and tell a little bit deeper and make that a real thing, it makes the past so much more tangible.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to balance, to show that imbalance, right? Like, oh, yeah, you know all these things about Abraham Lincoln because the man was a president. People cared enough to save it and wanted to know all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And we know more about Abraham than we do about Mary. Mm-hmm. And we know a whole lot about Mary. Mm-hmm. So how do we, you know, that mm-hmm. kind of pieces of the record and what we can tell from the record mm-hmm. is only as good as what we have access to.
Mm-hmm.
And that changes over through digitization or through mm-hmm. funding to be able to go to D.C. and sift through 10,000 archival boxes of paper and whatever it might be. And so you're going to get these uneven mm-hmm. stories based on where you are and the resources mm-hmm. available to those telling you the story.
Right. Or right. Like Mary's father, Robert Smith Todd, he was an important guy. You know, he was. And we know a lot about him, a lot about him. He came from an important family. They were among the founding families of Kentucky. There's just a lot we know about him. So sometimes when you're, say, at a museum or whatever, your instinct, you're talking to people, is to just tell all the stuff you know. And you just happen to know a whole lot about Robert Todd and don't really know a whole lot about, say, his wives. And then you can accidentally, like, we're basically just talking about him,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it's not that, you know, what he did is inconsequential or doesn't matter or something. It's just inadvertently you can end up giving them balance because it's the information that's easily available. And then that's just kind of what you end up talking about. So it kind of takes also restraint to not just accidentally turn it into the Robert Smith Todd tour.
Right. No, I think that's an important piece. And this has kind of flown through, been a through line through many of our podcasts and our talks, is that what is easy to tell, what is harder to get to, and how do we make sure that we're not defaulting to that easy mm-hmm. because we're so excited about all of it, mm-hmm. right? Like I think about this a lot when I give tours of the museum too, that like I get so jazzed about the tiniest detail, and then all of a sudden we're an hour into this tour and I've only made it to like the founding of Transylvania. There's a lot more history that needs to get done.
Mm-hmm. 250 years, as a
250 years. So it is that, like, for every, what I really will hope listeners take away is that every time we bring in a new character in a museum, every time we're able to bring a new story, what seems like a new story to the tour, that balances out what may have been known before. It means that we have to think differently about how we're bringing them through the house or through the museum or through the exhibit. And it's not taking away from what was there before. It's adding to the mix so you get even more of a chance to understand, you know, this is what the house sounded like and these were the people making that noise and this is what we know about them in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really powerful and really hopeful for the field. if people want to come see you, how do they do that?
Oh, well, we're open Monday through Saturday in downtown Lexington, Kentucky, and we're open from 10 to 4. We offer self-guided tours for most of the day, and our guided tour is offered at 3 o'clock. We do also, if we're Lexingtonians are listening, have a traveling pop-up exhibit that is currently making its way around town. It's currently at the Lexington Senior Center, and then it will head on to some library branches before it heads over to the Lexington History Museum in, I believe, October.
In October. Great. Well, Gwen, I'm so glad to have had this conversation, and I look forward to coming to see you soon, and I can't wait for those banners to be in the museum in October.
Yeah, and Gwen, I second that, and this has just been a really fascinating conversation and going in the directions, especially when we're talking about research and telling a more complete story or more of a story we know now more than we did maybe 20 years ago, 50 years ago. And good on you to embrace that. We've also seen that with Ashlyn, the Henry Clay estate of late as well. So we thank you very much for coming in today. And Mandy, that leads us to the month of June and what's going to happen at the museum.
Homecoming month. Maybe the biggest month for 250 Lex. So we're right in the middle of it. No giveaways and surprise details yet, but do know that a 250 Lex exhibit is coming to the Lexington History Museum in June.
Ooh, stay tuned for that. Yes, it's going to be a big one. We know that.
Yes. Yeah. And in the interim, you can visit us Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. Thursdays 12 to 4, Saturdays 10 to 4 for self-guided tours. So you can go hang out with Mary and then come up the street and see us. And then by appointment and, of course, group tours. And don't miss the international exhibit.
Yes. And so, obviously, we will be back very, very soon with another edition of Lex Talk History.
You've been listening to Lex Talk History, a monthly podcast produced in collaboration with WUKY and the Lexington History Museum. Subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts or download Lex Talk History from the podcast page at WUKY.org. And if you haven't done so already, please make plans to visit the Lexington History Museum soon. Get started on your tour at LexHistory.org.